So, hello, everybody. So today, this evening is starting the Exploring Monastic Life program. And this teaching that you're walking into tonight, and that you will hear on the other Friday nights too, is we're in the middle of going through this book. So the book is Following in the Buddha's Footsteps. It's volume 4 in the Library of Wisdom and Compassion by His Holiness Dalai Lama. And the book starts out talking about refuge. And then since the Dharma refuge is the three higher trainings, it then goes into explanations of the higher training of ethical conduct, higher training of concentration, higher training of wisdom. And the three higher trainings are common to all of the Buddhist traditions. So we've already covered the higher training in ethical conduct. We're in the middle of the higher training of concentration. So we've already talked about objects to use as the object of meditation for developing serenity. And then we've talked about the five hindrances. What are they? Sensual desire, malice, lethargy, and restlessness, isn't it? Oh, that's in the other one. Yeah, sorry. Okay, lethargy. Okay, there's doubt.
Yes, and restlessness and remorse.
And restlessness and remorse. There's restlessness with remorse. Okay, so those five are also common to all the Buddhist traditions. What we're going to be going into this evening is something that's unique to the Mahayana traditions. So you'll find it in Chinese Buddhism, Vietnamese, Tibetan Buddhism, because this explanation is according to Maitreya's, I think it's his, yeah, differentiation of the middle and extreme. Okay, but it hits on the same kind of impediments and things that block us from developing concentration, and I think you'll recognize them. Okay, but before we go into that, I want to finish up a section that we started on last time. We'll first do the chanting, taking refuge, generating bodhicitta, making a mandala offering to request the teachings. Actually, we start out praising the Buddha, yeah, and the Dharma and the Sangha, and then go on from there. So we imagine the Buddha surrounded by all the other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, Arhats, and so on, Dharma protectors in the space in front of us. And we're surrounded by all sentient beings. So just get the feeling of being in this massive Dharma gathering. Yeah, with so many holy beings and so many sentient beings who want to learn. So take a few minutes and let's do the breathing meditation to clear the mind in preparation for listening to teachings. And let's generate our motivation and think that we will listen to the teachings, not just to gain knowledge, but to understand how the path to cultivating concentration works, so that we can then put it into practice when we're ready to, and then use that skill of being able to concentrate well to generate the wisdom, knowing the ultimate nature, and to meditate on and actualize bodhicitta, the aspiration to attain full awakening for the benefit of each and every sentient being. So that bodhicitta motivation is supported by love and compassion for all beings. So take a moment and generate that as our motivation for sharing in the Buddha's teachings this evening. Okay, so last week we left off on one passage where it was talking about not holding on to the past, not ruminating about the future. Yeah, and we hear that a lot, I think, in all the Buddhist traditions. You know, keep the mind in the present, don't think about, fixate on the past or on the future. That doesn't mean that you should never think about the past or the future. If you didn't think about the future, you wouldn't have made travel arrangements to get here. If you didn't think about the past, you wouldn't know how to make travel arrangements to get here. Okay, so we have to think about the past and the future, you know, to function in our conventional world. However, when we're trying to develop single-pointedness in our meditation, then we don't want to go into the past, we don't want to go into the future, because our mind starts circling around, well, the past, what wonderful experiences did I have? How can I duplicate them again in the future? Or, oh, what horrible experiences I had in the past. Oh, can I take revenge on the people who caused them to me? You know, and we just get really stuck in a lot of attachment and a lot of resentment. Yeah. Okay. So, fortitude, continuous effort, and a relaxed mind free from unrealistic expectations are great aids to gaining serenity and other realizations. Those are also great aids for doing anything in our life. Yeah, because we tend to have so many ideas and thoughts and expectations. Like, you come to exploring monastic life, I'm sure, you know, all of you have different expectations about what it's going to be like, and, you know, worries, am I going to fit in, are people going to like me, am I going to like them, what is all this stuff about ordination, and why do I have to do it, can't I just be, declare myself a monastic by myself, you know, Or I want to, you know, I want to be a hermit. I'm, you know, after I leave here, I'm going to go into the Himalayas, find a nice, comfortable cave, you know, with central heating and air con in the summer, and, you know, become a great yogi. Yeah, and gain realizations really quick. Yeah, because I'm a super duper disciple. I have special abilities, yeah, that the world doesn't know about. I'm going to become a Buddha before everybody else here. Yeah. So you might have that idea. Yeah, as Venerable Jenny said at the lunch BBC, forget it. Or you might go to the other extreme of, oh no, there's so many rules. Oh, yeah, I'm so sick of rules. My parents gave me rules. Then there was the Ten Commandments. Yeah, I traded in the Ten Commandments for the Ten Non-Virtues. And that isn't even the precepts, you know, if I become fully ordained. Love for the monks is 253 rules. Ugh. For the nuns, there's even more, 348. Oh, yeah, who wants that? I want to be free and spontaneous, right? Yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay. So you may have all sorts of expectations about this program. You know, we have a very good imagination. When I say, you know, imagine the Buddha in the space in front, very difficult. Yeah. If I say, imagine pizza, very easy. Yeah. If I say, who do you want to imagine? Oh, if I say, don't imagine, fill in the blank, who are you going to imagine? Okay. So, yeah, your enemy, the person you don't like, well, you can imagine that person real easily. Yeah, fixate on them. Go round and around. Remembering all their negative qualities. Now, we never forget even one, because they have, anyway, if we did, they have so many we couldn't finish the list. Okay, so we're trying to clear our mind of all of that. So I'm reading what His Holiness says here. Some great Buddhist meditators dwell alone in the forest or mountains, not speaking to anyone and braving hardships. That's me. I'm going to brave all the hardships. Yeah. As long as my cave is heated. Yeah. And I have a comfortable bed in it. And a refrigerator. Okay. Hearing about them, you know, braving hardships and so on, some people have a romantic notion of living in solitude, withdrawn from the world. Yeah, I'm going to be a real yogi. Like, you know, you read about in the comic books, and then there's a few of them too in real life. Yeah. One day the Buddha heard about a bhikshu who was dwelling alone and who encouraged others to do so. He entered a village on alms round alone, returned to his isolated place alone, sat alone, and did walking meditation alone. Yeah. Calling this monk to him, the Buddha said that what he was doing was a way of dwelling alone, but the fulfilling the real purpose of dwelling alone differed. Okay, and so here's what the Buddha said. How is dwelling alone fulfilled in detail? Here, what lies in the past has been abandoned. What lies in the future has been relinquished. An attachment and sensual desire for present forms of individual existence have been thoroughly removed. The wise, all-conqueror, all-knower, among all things unsullied, will all cast off, liberated in the destruction of craving. I call that person one who dwells alone. Okay, so the point is, dwelling alone is not a physical thing. You can live alone and your mind can be full of all sorts of stuff about what's going on in the world. Okay, so here, dwelling alone is what he said at the beginning. Yeah, what lies in the past has been abandoned. In other words, you're not dwelling in the past. You're not thinking about, all the injustices people have caused you, all the things that weren't fair, the things you resented, the things you were deprived of, all that self-centered stuff, has been abandoned. In other words, the past is the past. We make peace with it and we leave it. We don't dwell in it wanting to recreate it. We don't dwell in it being angry, thinking that, oh, I should have really retaliated when somebody did this and that. Yeah, it was just the past is not happening now. Yeah, I can leave the past alone. If I have adopted certain thoughts and certain conditioning because of the past, that I need to deal with, okay? Because if we develop certain habits when we were young or middle-aged or old, and we develop those habits, especially emotional habits or thoughts, habitual views on things, then that can be an obscuration and something preventing us from progressing on the path. So we have to take out all that stuff and make peace with it and clear it up, okay? But so the influence it had on us that wasn't useful, that's what we, clear up. But dwelling in the past and holding things against other people and, dreaming of only if I had done this, then this would have happened, then that would have happened. We would have lived happily ever after. Forget it. Yeah, it's not happening now. Okay. So what lies in the past has been abandoned. What lies in the future has been relinquished. Why relinquished? Yeah, doesn't mean that you're not going to have any future experiences. What it means is all your hopes and fears about the future, those are what you're relinquishing. Okay, so all your hope of, I'll attend EML and I'll come out, with clarity in my mind, whatever it is. Or, things of, in the past I blew something, I don't want to blow it now. All these kinds of things. So we're relinquishing the attachment and aversion that we'd have towards future things. Okay, because we can spend a lot of time daydreaming, can't we? Yeah, we can spend a lot of time ruminating, and none of it is happening now. Yeah, but we can make ourselves quite miserable through all of that. Yeah. Okay. What lies in the past has been abandoned. What lies in the future has been relinquished. An attachment and sensual desire for present forms of individual existence have been thoroughly removed. So attachment and sensual desire for what's happening now. We want everything to be comfortable and wonderful now. Yeah, then we're kind of giving that too. Yeah, it's been thoroughly removed. Okay, so what that verse is doing is it's saying clear your mind of all this kind of stuff of the past and the future, and your past traumas and injustices and your future dreams and hopes and imaginations, and just do your practice. Yeah, just do your practice. It sounds simple, yeah? But how many of you, the people who live here, have done retreat and spent time in retreat thinking of everything you want to study when retreat is over and all the other retreats you want to do in the future? Yeah, and thinking about what happened to you in the past, how people were unfair and they didn't respect you and blah, blah. Yeah, or thinking about your future spreadsheets. Yeah. Yes, we have the chief of spreadsheet makers as a member of the Abbey, yeah. And yeah, we can make a spreadsheet about everything, yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. So you're dreaming about your future spreadsheets, thinking about the past ones, thinking that you should delete them because if some people remembered, looked at your past ones, they might think you were a little bit nuts. No? Oh, they would look at your past ones and think what a great spreadsheeter she was. Yeah? Yeah. Creating fantastic spreadsheets, yeah. Okay. So then it goes into, yeah, the wise one, all conqueror, all knower. So referring to somebody here with realizations. Among all things unsullied, how are you unsullied among everything you come in contact with? By not having attachment and anger and jealousy and arrogance. Then whatever presents itself to you, yeah, you're not getting involved in it. Yeah, you use things for the benefit of others. Yeah, and you use things to keep yourself alive. Yeah, but you're not sullied with, yeah, all this planning and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, all your dreams about inheriting $1 million and everything you're going to spend it on. Yeah, but having $1 million, I think, is going to keep you busy, you know, because then you have to have a financial advisor, yeah, who's going to tell you what to invest in and what the markets are doing. And then you're going to worry about putting your money in that instead of this. And, you know, you think having $1 million is going to bring you a lot of peace of mind. It's going to keep you busy. Yeah. Okay. Liberated in the destruction of craving. So somebody who's given up craving. Yeah. Who can be happy with whatever they have. And one of my teachers used to say, you know, when we would If people would say, oh, you know, this isn't good enough, or I'm not good enough, or, you know, and one of his big expressions was good enough, dear. He called everybody dear. Yeah, good enough, dear. What you're doing is good enough. What you have is good enough. Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice to feel that way about your life? Yeah. Instead of, oh, I'm missing something, I want more, I want better. No, just what I have is good enough. I'm satisfied, I'm content. Okay, so then the last line says, I call that person one who dwells alone. Okay, so that person is one who dwells alone because their mind isn't filled with all sorts of stuff. Yeah, their mind is alone or peaceful. Yeah. Okay, so here it's going to go into describing the lines a little bit. So the line, abandoning what lies in the past, means releasing attachment and sensual desire for the aggregates, the body and mind, of the past, which include the material possessions, reputation, praise, appreciation, and so forth, we have received in the past. Really? Releasing attachment for my material possessions, but I work so hard to get these things and I like them, and my reputation, to give up attachment to my reputation, ay, 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 I can't do that. Yeah, give up attachment to praise and appreciation, impossible, I want more of those. Okay, yeah, do you see what I mean about how our mind is grasping and craving for stuff? Okay, relinquishing what lies in the future is to give up attachment to the body and mind, the aggregates of the future with all of its inner and outer trappings. Oh, in the future, I want to be born so I look like Beyoncé. Yeah, and have a voice like Beyoncé's. Or maybe I want to be like, what's her name? Taylor Slow. Yeah, and her sister, Seamstress Swift. Yeah, I want to be like them. Yeah, the guys want to be like, who do you want to be like? Rambo. No, no. Tell me, who do you want to be like?
His Holiness.
His Holiness. Oh, okay. Yeah. So, you know, all these things of, you know, yeah. Okay, just putting it down. Removing attachment to present forms of existence. In the poem, is to leave aside attachment to present sensual desires. In short, abandoning the view of a personal identity, that's the self-grasping of the person, and craving for existence in the past, present, and future, is the highest meaning of dwelling alone. Keeping this in mind is important, lest conceit arise. Okay, so it's very easy to get conceited as a Dharma practitioner. Yeah. I am a great meditator doing what others cannot do. Or maybe that's a little bit too advanced for me to be a great meditator. I keep my precepts better than anybody else. I am the most compassionate one in this community. Yeah. Everybody knows who I am. Even the cats. Maybe only the cat. Yeah? Okay. So I am a great meditator, doing what others cannot. I hope others speak well of me and bring me offerings because they respect my renunciation. I'm so renounced of sensual pleasures that I hope they respect me and bring me lots of sensual pleasures. Yeah. Actually, such a person may have given up good food, but they are nourishing their conceit instead. Yeah. Then all conqueror in the verse is one who has overcome compulsive rebirth in samsara. Unsullied is one who has given up craving and views. All cast off is freeing oneself from all defilement, and liberated in the destruction of craving is the attainment of arhatship. So that second verse there talks about how to progress to arhatship. If we keep this in mind, we will train our mind to dwell alone in peace, separate from defilements. Okay, here's a reflection. So first point, what does it mean to abandon what lies in the past, in the future, and in the present? Okay, so this is your homework you're thinking about. It might be very good to jot down some notes. What do you think you're clinging on to in the past, or in the present, in the future, that it would really help you to just put it down and give it up? And then the second point, to function in society, we need to remember what we have learned in the past, to plan for the future, and to act in the present. Surely the Buddha is not instructing us to do nothing. Yeah, people say, oh, give up the past. Don't think about the past. Don't think about the future. Oh, so I just sit there and go, whatever. I don't care. ICE is going into neighborhoods and arresting people who didn't do anything wrong and sending them to live in Darfur. Well, yeah, I've given up everything. That's not what it's talking about. Okay, so how do we integrate the Buddha's advice to abandon what lies in the past, the present, and the future with being an effective person like he himself was? The Buddha was an effective person, wasn't it? But he didn't dwell in the past, the present, and the future. So what would that look like? So this is something to think about. Okay, now we're going to move into the next section. So this is called the five faults and the eight antidotes. The Sanskrit tradition, as practiced in Tibet and China, relies on the texts of Maitreya and Asanga for instructions on the method to cultivate serenity. It still talks about the five hindrances that are common in the Pali tradition, but it's emphasizing this section here. Maitreya spoke of five faults that impede serenity and eight antidotes that eliminate these five faults. Okay, so just in brief, yeah, laziness is a fault. And the antidotes are confidence or faith, aspiration, effort, and pliancy. And we'll go through and explain all these. Second fault is called forgetting the instruction, but what it means is you've forgotten your object to meditation. Yeah? And so mindfulness is the antidote. The third fault, two things put together, restlessness and laxity, and their antidote is introspective awareness. The fourth fault is non-application of the antidote, and the antidote is application of the antidotes. And then the next fault is over-application of the antidote, and its antidote is equanimity. Okay, so that's just what the chart abbreviates. We'll go into all of that now. Okay, so the first hindrance is laziness, and its antidotes are confidence or faith, aspiration, effort, and pliancy. So the laziness, maybe you'll know what I'm talking about. So laziness comes in three forms: sleeping a lot and lying around, doing nothing much at all. We procrastinate. Who does that? Okay, second form of laziness: keeping ourselves busy with worldly activities, work, socializing, shopping, looking at the latest happenings on our devices, and that makes us lack time to meditate. Anybody keep themselves super busy doing things that are not so important? And then the third one, this one is our specialty. Overwhelmed by discouragement, we feel inadequate and don't try to train our minds. In other words, we give up on ourselves. Now, this is a big problem. So it is easy to identify instances of all three types of laziness in our lives. Overcoming them is more difficult. Okay, all three interfere with our ability to gain serenity. And the serenity is concentration here. In the context of cultivating serenity, laziness refers to not wanting to do the practice to develop serenity. Yeah, you don't want to do the practice first because you're sleeping a lot, laying around, doing much, not much, and procrastinating. Yeah. Mañana en la mañana. I'll do it tomorrow morning. Yeah. Then this one. So think about the second one. Keeping ourselves busy with worldly activities. We got to go to work. We have a social life. We have to go shopping. Then we got to keep up with the latest things on social media. We've got to, you know, watch TikTok and the people, that we're following on TikTok, and be able to discuss all of that with our friends at work, because that's what people are talking about. And so, you know, we're just being really busy with everything, so there's no time for our practice. Sound familiar? Yeah. And then somebody says, well, you know, there's 24 hours in a day. You could give up some of those things, and then you would have more time to practice. Oh, no, well, I've got to go to work, and I have to work overtime because I'm saving my money to get that that red Porsche convertible. Yeah, so I got to work really hard to get that. And I have a big social life. I can't just opt out of that. You know, all my friends will be unhappy. And, you know, I have a lot of correspondence. I am texting all the time, morning, noon, and night. Last thing I do in the evening is I check my phone and I text goodnight to somebody. First thing in the morning, what do I do? I look at who has texted me and what messages I have. And then the whole day goes on from there. Yeah. Give up looking at social media. Oh, if I didn't do that, then none of my friends would talk to me. I would be so boring. Yeah, I've got to know what everybody ate for breakfast, you know, check on what they've posted, you know. Yeah. Sound familiar? Yeah. Some of you going, yes. Yeah. Some of you look at me like I'm nuts. Yeah. We keep ourselves busy, don't we? Yeah. And then we got to think of all the things we want to buy, you know, because we have to, you know, get what's in style. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when you go to a yoga retreat, you have to have yoga clothes, don't you? You can't just show up in jeans in a yoga retreat. Yeah, you have to have yoga clothes. Yeah, you come here. What do you need? Yeah, a t-shirt and some, what do we call them? The loose ones that are fit. What, sweatpants, yeah. Oh, so I've got to go out and buy some new t-shirts and sweatpants, yeah. Yeah, because I want to look like everybody else. Yeah. I don't want to look weird. Okay, so busy. We keep, one of my teachers called us the busiest of the busy. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, and we've got to go jogging. Yeah, and then we have to look at our thing that tells us how many steps we've taken and make sure that we've gotten enough exercise. Yeah. Okay, and then the one about discouragement and feeling inadequate. This one is a big problem for people in the West. Yeah, because we just kind of say, you know, they passed out Buddha nature and I didn't get any. Everybody else has Buddha nature and can become a Buddha, but not me. Yeah, I've messed up so many things. I've had relationships and they've all fallen apart because of me. Not everybody in my family likes me. At work, I have so many problems. People are better than me. Even I go to the monastery, they're all sitting in perfect meditation position, and I'm wiggling and can't sit still. Woe is me. Yeah, I can't do this. This Buddhism trip, it sounded so good when I read the advertisement. Yeah, enlightenment in this life. Yeah, I want that. Yeah, but then I got there and they told me what I had to do to get enlightened in this life. Forget it. Takes too long, too hard. Yeah, I can't have any chocolate. I gotta give up sex. My boyfriend, I'm gonna miss him and his dirty socks so much. Yeah, and you know, it's all my fault and I'm just not good enough. Hmm? And what's the proof? Well, like I said, I didn't get any Buddha nature when they passed it out, and I have original sin. They taught me that when I was this big, that I was born sinful. Okay. Yeah? Anybody have that kind of conditioning growing up? Yeah? That can really get in the way. Yeah, if you are thinking just by your mere existence that you're defective goods and you're sinful, that's heavy duty. Yeah, and that's not what the Buddha says. Yeah, that's not the Buddhist perspective. Okay. So we have to really take out things from the past, especially, you know, when we were brought up. Very often when parents discipline their kids, they don't know how to discipline their kids very well, you know, because you don't need to take a course or get a license to become a parent. Yeah, it's kind of a free for all. And, you know, and then you have a kid and yeah, you want your kid to be everything that you aren't, to have everything you don't have, haven't been able to have, to fulfill all your aspirations, that you do things that you weren't able to do. So you want your kid to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, we look at that. We love our parents. We want to please them. Can we be everything they want us to be? Do we even want to be everything they want us to be? Yeah, they want you to be an engineer. You hate math. Yeah. They want you to be an artist. All you can draw is stick figures. No, and then you say, yeah, I'm just, something's wrong with me. And parents often, say to kids, you know, kind of like good boy, good girl, or bad boy, bad girl. And that's not giving a child any useful information, except the kid hears, you know, I'm bad, for example, or I'm good. But they usually say that first of, you know, oh, you're bad, you did this. And then if we correct ourselves, they say you're good. But, you know, what does, when somebody says you're bad, does that give you any useful information except to know that the other person is unhappy with something? Yeah, it doesn't tell you what they're unhappy about. In fact, they're putting their unhappiness on you, saying you're bad. And you don't know what you did. What did I do? I didn't clean my room. I didn't eat my whole peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Or I ate two peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Yeah, you don't get any useful information, somebody telling you you're bad or you're good. But many of us have been raised hearing that. You're bad, you're good. We have to look at that and realize that's, it's just words. It is not who we are. Yeah, it is not who we are. So this involves a lot of unpacking. Okay. But all three of those kinds of laziness interfere with our Dharma practice, and in this context, interfere with our ability to generate serenity. Yeah. For example, yeah. So you're trying to visualize the image of the Buddha, let's say, or you're using the breath as your object to meditation. Yeah, you get maybe through one or two breaths, and then your mind is distracted. Yeah? Then you bring it back. Another two breaths, you're distracted again. And then you just say, yeah, what's the use? I can't do this. Too hard. Yeah. And that way of thinking, yeah, we give up on ourselves. We shoot ourselves in the foot and then wonder why we can't walk. Yeah. So this kind of mind, we really have to notice when it comes up, you know, and really see that it's total, it's a whole bunch of lies, basically. It's a whole bunch of lies. And a lot of our self-talk, what we say to ourselves, is lying. Yeah, I can't do this. Well, you know, if somebody asked me to move one of those big rocks out there. Yeah, that's accurate. I can't do that. Yeah. But some things I'm just lazy, or I don't have a lot of self-confidence. So I just kind of say I can't. And then I go ask somebody else for help. I'm very good at that. Yeah, so be careful. I'll probably ask you for help at some time. Yeah. But I have a good reason for that. Okay. Okay, so the actual antidote to laziness in the context of cultivating serenity is mental pliancy. Since it takes a while to strengthen this mental factor, we begin, this is how we begin, it's important, by cultivating confidence or faith in the benefits of serenity and concentration. Okay, so really thinking about the benefits of whatever you aspire to do, especially in a spiritual way, to think about the benefits of being able to do that. We have to start off thinking of that, not thinking of the expectations that we're going to get it quickly, but thinking of, oh, if I could develop that quality, wow, that would be really nice. So you develop faith or confidence in that quality, yeah. That leads you to, I'll read from here and then explain. These benefits include mental calm and peace, freedom from the coarse destructive emotions, the ability to remain focused on a virtuous object without distraction. Wouldn't that be nice? And a clear, powerful mind that facilitates the realization of emptiness. So we think about the benefits of developing serenity. Yeah. For those of you who may have heard the Sanskrit and Pali term shamatha, that's what I'm translating as serenity here. Okay, so confidence is a joyous state of mind, and it gives rise to aspiration, which is interested in and aspires to cultivate serenity. Okay, so aspiration is a very important element in our spiritual practice. Yeah, there's when we recite the King of Prayers, yeah, another way to translate it is the King of Aspiration Prayers. Yeah, because in order to achieve something, yeah, we first have to have confidence in it and see its good qualities. And then we have to aspire to develop it. If we don't have any aspiration, we won't do anything. Yeah. So even though aspiration isn't getting up and doing it, it's a very important step that helps us eventually to get up and do it. Yeah, because the third antidote to laziness is effort. Okay, so confidence, yeah, and the benefits gives rise to aspiration. Aspiration gives rise to effort. Yeah, I not only aspire that, but I'm going to put some energy into cultivating it. Yeah, and that gets us going. Okay, so this leads to effort that takes delight in concentration and is enthusiastic to attain it. This is like, His Holiness is giving an example. This is like having confidence in the qualities of a product advertised on TV. We aspire to buy it and happily make the effort to do so. That's kind of, yeah. And so you'll notice in all the steps on the path, yeah, the Buddha and Tsongkhapa always start off talking about the benefits of a certain practice. Yeah, because if we see the benefits, then we'll aspire for it, then we'll start to exert effort. And then, yeah, on the path to attain serenity, we pass through the 9 stages of sustained attention, during which we abandon the faults and hindrances to concentration, especially restlessness and laxity. Yeah. And so that leads to pliancy, the 4th antidote, which is actually what accomplishes it. It's the pliancy that eliminates or overcomes. It doesn't eliminate it completely. It overcomes restlessness and laxity. Yeah, you know restlessness and laxity? Yeah. Okay, so pliancy is a mental factor that is free from all physical and mental unserviceability. In other words, factors that impede the body and mind from cultivating virtue whenever we like. Yeah, with both physical and mental pliancy, our body feels light and flexible, and our mind easily remains focused on whatever virtuous object we choose. Okay, so pliancy is a mind that's flexible. Yeah, it's flexible. It can deal with whatever comes up. Yeah, it is, another translation is it's serviceable. You can use it. Yeah, so it's a pliant, you know, like something that's pliant, it's flexible, it adapts. Yeah, and yet it still knows where it's going. So, and there's physical pliancy and mental pliancy. So physical pliancy is when your body feels really relaxed due to concentration. Yeah, your body's relaxed. Mental pliancy is your mind is flexible. You can place it on whatever object you want to meditate on, and it will stay there. Yeah. Okay. Now, then the second fault, second of the 5 faults, is forgetting its instruction, which means forgetting the object of meditation. Mm-hmm. And its antidote is mindfulness. Okay. So forgetting the instruction means forgetting the meditation object. Having overcome coarse laziness, yeah, we get ourselves onto the meditation cushion, yeah, and try to, we sit on the meditation cushion and try and concentrate. But what happens? Our untrained mind quickly strays from the observed object to objects of attachment, anger, jealousy, and worry. Okay, so we sit down and, you know, you start focusing on the breath, and then you start thinking, okay, what room am I in? What's the name of the building I'm in? What's my roommate's name? Gee, I picked one bed. Did I pick the bed that's most comfortable? Maybe I should have picked another bed in the room. Yeah, your mind gets distracted. Doesn't it? Yeah. Or, oh, I just arrived at a new place. Yeah, they do such weird, funny things. Yeah, they wear weird clothes. Yeah. Yeah. Men in skirts, women with shaved heads. What in the world is this place like? Okay, oh yeah, I'm supposed to be focusing on the breath or the image of the Buddha. Okay, yeah, back to that. But this place really is weird. Yeah. There's dirt everywhere. I'm out in the countryside. I'm used to the city where it's clean. Yeah. I would be so nice The usual center I go to, it's in the city, it's clean. I want to go back there. Well, no, I don't. Yeah, I've been there, done that. Yeah, oh, yeah, I'm supposed to be on the breath, on the image of the Buddha. Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, let's come back. Okay, sound familiar? We forget the instruction. Yeah, the antidote is mindfulness. Now, okay, I'm sure all of you think you know what mindfulness is because you've listened to a mindfulness app. Yeah, how many of you listen to mindfulness apps? Two people, right. Let's try that again. How many of you have listened to mindfulness apps? Okay, yeah. So what do they tell you in mindfulness apps? Well, there's a lot of different mindfulness apps, yeah. And they're all talking about what I call secular mindfulness. So some mindfulness apps will, you know, tell you to just focus on your breath, or some of them will tell you just relax your mind and imagine lying on the beach, you know, with your boyfriend, your girlfriend, yeah, kind of lead you through some kind of imagination thing. Or they say, just note whatever is arising in your mind. But yikes, what's arising in my mind? This is boring. What's the use of it? Yeah. Yeah. Or whatever arises in your mind. Yeah. All of a sudden, oh, my arm itches. I got to scratch it. Yeah. So. Or your stomach hurts. You were fine when you came into the hall. Yeah. Then all of a sudden, oh, okay. Yeah. So we forgetting the instruction means, we, you know, at the beginning, mindfulness in a Buddhist context, yeah, is the ability to keep your mind on the object. Yeah. The word mindfulness in Pali and Tibetan and Sanskrit is the same verbal root as to remember. Yeah. So you're remembering your object of meditation. Yeah. You're not remembering the past. You're remembering what you want to focus on right now. So that's what mindfulness is. Yeah. So when your mind gets distracted and it's off, yeah, you have to renew your mindfulness, which means that you take your, you know, that you redirect your mind to come back to the object that you're focusing on. Okay. That's mindfulness. And it's interesting too. So that's the kind of mindfulness we develop we start out developing mindfulness in our ethical conduct, because we have to be mindful of how we want to walk, how we want to speak, and, you know, what's going on in our mind. And that kind of mindfulness that we use so that we create virtue instead of non-virtue, that is developing the mental factor of mindfulness, which helps in the second higher training, the higher training of concentration, where mindfulness shifts so that you're not remembering, you know, how you want to act or how you want to speak. You're remembering your object to meditation. Mm-hmm. When you get to the higher training in wisdom, then your mindfulness is coupled with wisdom. So you're not just remembering something or focusing on your object, but you're looking at it and understanding it. Yeah, your mindfulness is together with wisdom. Mm-hmm. Okay, so forgetting the instruction means forgetting the meditation object. Having overcome coarse laziness, we sit on the meditation cushion, try and concentrate, but our untrained mind quickly strays from the observed object to objects of attachment, anger, jealousy, and worry. Instead of focusing on the meditation object, we think about future vacation sites or the argument we had with a colleague in the past. The antidote is mindfulness, a mental factor that is familiar with the meditation object and holds the mind on it in such a way that distraction and forgetfulness cannot arise. Okay, so it's a mental factor, it's a characteristic, you know, that of the mind, that it's familiar with the meditation object. So when we begin meditating, yeah, we're not familiar with the meditation object. Yeah, we're not, unless your meditation object is pizza, but none of the teachers I know recommend that. Yeah, as your meditation object. But, you know, you have to develop familiarity with it. Yeah. And it holds the mind on it in such a way that distraction can't arise and forgetting the object by, you know, getting drowsy or whatever, that can't arise. Mindfulness is closely related to memory and applies only to an object with which we are well acquainted. Yeah, so why does our mind get distracted easily? Because we're not well acquainted. Yeah, we haven't done the meditation a lot. And so we don't have a habit, we don't have familiarity with it. Yeah, so, you know, one way to overcome that distraction is to develop familiarity with whatever we're meditating on. Yeah. Okay. Losing the meditation object mainly occurs on the first four stages of sustained attention. So I just said that there were nine stages of sustained attention. So in the first four, we often tend to lose the object. Losing the object is like a child running out of the room. Mindfulness is analogous to bringing him back inside. Our mind runs off to something else, and we have to bring it back to the object of meditation. By continually bringing our mind back to the observed object of our meditation, whenever it strays, mindfulness makes the distracting thoughts gradually subside. So we're developing a new mental habit. Yeah, a habit of focusing on this particular object. So Baba Viveka said, and this is a quote from him, "The elephant of the mind wandering wildly is to be securely bound with the rope of mindfulness to the pillar of a meditation object and is gradually tamed with the hook of wisdom." That's a beautiful quote. Okay, so you have an elephant. Yeah, in ancient India and in modern India, sometimes you have mad elephants and they're like ghosts tromping, running everywhere, tromping over the, you know, the huts, trampling on the crops. They're just totally out of control. Okay, so the elephant of the mind wandering wildly, yeah, is to be securely bound by the rope of mindfulness. You have to bind an elephant with a rope. Okay, what is our rope? Mindfulness. To bind the wild elephant of our mind. What are we bonding, or binding the mind to? The pillar of the meditation object. So if you're taming an elephant, it's to some really big pillar. Yeah, but we want to, you know, put our mind on the meditation object. And it's gradually tamed with the hook of wisdom. So I guess elephant trainers have a hook. And I don't know how they, what the part of the how they use the hook. Yeah, on the ears. They hook them behind the ears. And the feet. Yeah. They tap the feet and yank them. Yeah. And so you gradually can train an elephant. That's kind of amazing. If you've ever, how many of you ever stood right next to an elephant? Yeah, I mean, like right next, this far away. Yeah. And without a fence in between you, you're not at a zoo. Yeah, but a real elephant. Yeah, it's like, hello up there. They are big, you know, and their feet are enormous. And you look at your foot, which is, you know, small in comparison, and you think, if that elephant shifts his position, my foot is going to be like squished. Yeah. And the elephant is tamed and it just stands there. Totally amazing. Yeah. Yeah. Elephant is better than a little kid. Can you get a little kid to stay put? Okay. So ethical conduct is a precursor to serenity because it develops mindfulness in daily life activities. Yeah. And so that's one thing you'll be working on while you're here, you know, being mindful and aware of what we're doing, and not just, you know, oh yeah, I'm mindful that I'm getting angry. I'm mindful that I'm really angry. I'm mindful that I want to tell this person off. I'm mindful that I'm opening my mind and criticizing them. No, that is not the mindfulness, okay? Yeah, what mindfulness means is like, oh, I'm aware that I'm angry. Yeah, I need to apply the antidote. Yeah, because I don't want to stay angry or whatever it is. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so losing the object is like a child running out of the room. Mindfulness is analogous to bringing him back inside. So ethical conduct is a precursor to serenity because it develops mindfulness in daily life activities. Whether we are walking, standing, sitting, or lying, those are the four physical positions, we must maintain mindfulness of our precepts and of suitable behavior for that situation. Yeah, so every situation we go in, there's suitable behavior and then there's unsuitable behavior. Yeah, if we aren't mindful and remember what suitable behavior is in a situation, we could do something, you know, that hurts somebody's feelings, that disrupts the situation, that is really rude and inconsiderate, because we're not mindful of, oh, this is a situation that requires me to kind of act in a certain way, or, you know, something like that. Yeah. So in ethical conduct, we need that kind of mindfulness. Otherwise, we'll be like one of those wild elephants. Yeah, you're standing in the food line, you know, And it's like, oh, my mindfulness is gone. And they have just what I like, pickles and peanut butter. So you put all the pickles and peanut butter in your bowl, and you're so happy. You walk out and sit down and eat. You don't look happy. Yeah, I don't like pickles and peanut butter either. That's why I use the example, they can eat it. Yeah, no, I'm joking. But, you know, is that suitable behavior, you know, to go and just take up everything that you happen to like? Yeah. Okay. You know, and there's certain situations where we act in one way, and then in other situations when we act in the opposite way. But we have to have this kind of sensitivity to things to keep good ethical conduct. Okay. So whether we were walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, we must maintain mindfulness of our precepts and of suitable behavior for that situation. Doing this facilitates mindfulness of our meditation object, because physical and verbal actions are easier to control than mental activity. So conscientiousness, this is another mental factor, is a mental factor that values thinking, speaking, and acting constructively. So if we have a strong mental factor of conscientiousness, then we want to speak and act in a constructive way for the situation, not in a disruptive way, not in an inconsiderate way. Talking and having a busy social life cause many thought preconceptions to flood our minds. By speaking and socializing less, unrealistic and unbeneficial conceptualizations gradually decrease. Does that mean that we don't talk to anybody and we don't socialize at all? Yeah? No, it doesn't mean that. We're living our lives. We, you know, have to be normal people. But as Holiness says, one meditator I know in Dharamsala spends 6 days of the week in total silence, but talks a little on the day his attendant brings his weekly supplies. Sometimes even for several months, he will not talk at all. While this is not practical for most of us, we should try to speak only what is necessary, wise, kind, and appropriate to the circumstances. So this is really important, yeah? To speak, to act only in a way that's wise, kind, we care about others, necessary, not just babble, and appropriate to the situation. Yeah, because so something that it might be okay to say in one situation, not in another situation. And some things are not appropriate to say or do in any situation. And if we're not mindful, then we just, you know, say anything that pops in our mind or do anything that pops in our mind, and then we wonder why we have problems with people. Yeah, it's because sometimes we're not so considerate. Yeah. Okay, so chatting here and there with this person and that disturbs our meditation as well as the people around us. So if we're busybodies and we always have to talk and know what's going on with everybody, yeah, then in your meditation, you're going to be thinking about what everybody's doing. Okay, so let's stop here for today. Any questions or comments? All of you have open eyes, but maybe the mind isn't open, yeah?
The initial quote that you were reading at the beginning about not dwelling on the past or the future reminded me of how little PTSD there was in the Tibetan refugee community after they fled, despite all the torture and things that had happened. I think you've told the story about how there were some psychologists who wanted to help, and some of the elders said, just give us a few years to work with our people and see if they need it. And then they came back later, and they didn't need that much psychological help because they were practicing.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of this. It's like they weren't, my assumption is they weren't dwelling on what had happened, but they were moving forward in constructive ways.
Yeah.
So that kind of reminded me of that.
Yeah, very much.
Uh-huh. With forgetting the instructions and its antidote, I find that when I am drowsy, it is nearly impossible for me to remember the instructions and apply the antidote because my mind is just so sunken. And I'm curious if you have things that you do. Besides, I try to, you know, visualize a light, but even then my mind just is, you know, so drowsy that I don't even think about actually visualizing light and things like that.
Yeah. So what are you doing about it?
Trying to make my tea extra strong.
Yeah.
And get a little more sleep.
Does more sleep help? Sometimes sleeping too much makes you more lethargic.
I don't have the issue of sleeping too much around here.
Okay, what else do you do?
Well, I try to set an intention of like, if I fall asleep, I'm going to open my eyes. But even then, I can like set it at the beginning of my practice, but still, you know, not actually follow through on that.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why they say when you're meditating, leave your eyes a little bit open, because that lets the light in and that makes drowsiness harder. Or do what Lama Yeshe had the voice do. You know?
I probably should do that.
Yeah, you put a little bowl of water on your head. Yeah. You two sit next to each other. You can do that. And yeah, we'll see who has dry robes at the end of the session. But it works. Yeah. Also, you know, looking at something light and looking long distances. Yeah, I think when we were looking for land, I really wanted a place where you could look, you know, look across the valley, look to see something far away, where the night times were often clear, you know, where you could look very far and, you know, you see a star and you see, think, you know, gee, that looks so little, but it's huger, you know, than gazillions of times bigger than our Earth, which I think is already big. And like, what's going on at that star? Are there living beings around it? And, you know, something where you could stretch your mind. And that's quite important, I think, for meditation. Yeah. Otherwise, it's like, you know, okay, I'm going to concentrate. Yeah, we think if I only squeeze myself, then I could stay on the object. That's not actually so skillful. Yeah, squeezing yourself and, you know, making your mind tight. I'm going to stay on this. I'm not going to get distracted. Yeah. That just makes your mind actually distracted because your mind is so tight. Prostrations, are you doing prostrations?
We do them before practice, you know, in the morning practice and usually in the evening practice.
Uh-huh. Yeah, have you done the Nundro?
In process.
In process, yeah. Because that will help a lot, purifying. That helps a lot. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
For further clarification on the water bowl technique,
uh-huh.
Is it, so once I nod off and it's spilled and woken everyone up. Do I refill it, or do you just get one yes. shot per session?
No, you refill it. So by the end of the session, you've taken a bath. Yeah. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
It's from last week on page 185.
Uh-huh.
And the paragraph says, when he has abandoned these, there's still some subtle impurities that cling to him, namely thoughts about his relatives, his home country, and his reputation. So my question is, it doesn't seem to me that those things are subtle.
Yeah, me neither.
They're really quite gross.
Yes.
A real.
I agree with you. But maybe they're subtler than some of the things that before. But still. But they say, you know, for people who go in and do solitary retreat, that attachment for reputation can come really strong. Because you're really working on your practice, and one part of your mind is saying, okay, all my friends know that I'm in retreat. Do they know how good my meditation is? Yeah. Are they talking about me and how they know me and how I'm so noble that I've gone off to meditate? Yeah. It's very easy to have that kind of attachment, they say, come up. And I talked to one friend of mine who did a few years retreat, and she said everything comes up, and she started, she specifically mentioned the jingles from the commercials you heard as a child, that all those jingles come up when you're doing retreat. Yeah, you're supposed to be meditating on something profound. And then, you know, what's our favorite jingle? MICKEYMOUSE. Oh, the young ones, you guys don't know that. No? You've never heard of that? Oh, deprived people. On this side, have you heard it? Yeah? No? Huh? What?
Mainly from you.
Mainly from me. Yeah, thanks. Okay. Yeah. But all the old ones, we know it. Yeah. Yeah. We know it by heart. We never forgot it. And we didn't even have to try and remember it. It just came naturally. Yeah. Try and remember the prayers. Yeah. MICKEYMOUSE. What does it spell? Mickey Mouse. Yeah, this is the theme song for the Mouseketeers. Huh? What?
So I think it was on when I was a child, but it was on the Disney Channel, which was like a special premium channel. So it might be that we don't know it because we didn't have access to the special premium Disney
Channel.
Oh, I
see. You were deprived as a child. Yes. Yeah. If you had only been born in the 50s. Yeah. Okay. But I'm sure they have it in the movies. Anyway. Okay. Enough about Mickey Mouse. Okay, so let's dedicate. And then, well, we'll dedicate, and then I have some instructions what will follow.